Democrips and Rebloodlicans. No More Gangs in Government. By Jesse Ventura with Dick Russell. Narrated by Johnny Heller. Copyright 2012 by Jesse Ventura with Dick Russell. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Skyhorse Publishing Incorporated and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. There is no nation on earth powerful enough to accomplish our overthrow. Our destruction, should it come at all, will be from another quarter. From the inattention of the people to the concerns of their government. From their carelessness and negligence. I must confess that I do apprehend some danger. I fear that they may place too implicit a confidence in their public servants and fail properly to scrutinize their conduct. That in this way they may be made the dupes of designing men and become the instruments of their own undoing. Make them intelligent, and they will be vigilant. Give them the means of detecting the wrong, and they will apply the remedy. Daniel Webster. Chapter 1. Gang Warfare. Democrips versus Rebloodlicans. Let me start out by explaining the title of this book for those listeners who might not be familiar with the Crips and the Bloods. The Crips were a street gang founded in Southern California in 1969 and were looking to unite local gang members in South Central Los Angeles to battle other street gangs. According to Crips founder Stanley Tukey Williams, blue eventually became the color associated with the Crips after one of their first members, Buddha, who habitually wore a blue bandana, was shot and killed in February 1973. As time went on, the Crips became popular and were able to incorporate other gangs into their ranks. With more than 35,000 estimated members, the Crips engaged in a whole slew of illegal activities, ranging from drug distribution and extortion to the general spread of gang-related violence through the 70s and 80s. The Bloods formed in reaction to the Crips in 1972, initially founded by members of the Piru's Street Gang, a faction that broke off from the Crips. The Bloods set themselves apart by resorting to extreme violence and the production of crack cocaine in the 1980s. They got some help with that from the federal government, which used the proceeds to fund the Nicaraguan Contras. The color for the Bloods, not too surprisingly, is red. Okay, think about this for a moment. The color schemes, for example. Think red states and blue states. Aren't the Republicans considered the red state party and the Democrats blue like the Crips? Besides trying to kill each other off while building up their own coffers with funds for favors, don't the Republicans and the Democrats do everything they can to incorporate any neighboring street gangs? The current state of political discourse and activity in our country is one that bears a close resemblance to gangland warfare. So in my view, it's highly appropriate to equate Demo Crips and Rebloodlicans with their street counterparts. The only difference is that the two parties, gangs, have just been at it longer. The two political gangs have their turf, and that's what they protect. They operate identically with street gangs. Dues are paid by members of the gang. All decisions are made within the gang. There's hierarchy within the gang. Gang members became the admired objects of rap songs, and the party, gang, members have become media celebrities. And why do we allow them to use a fun word like party? When you say party, you think of a joyous occasion. My Webster's Dictionary defines party as a social gathering or assembly of persons for entertainment, amusement, or pleasure, as in party goer, party time, party girl, party hardy, party on, and so forth. Everybody loves to party. Well, I guess our politics have pretty much become entertainment, but you'd think we might take governance more seriously than to just identify it with partying. Besides, what these people are doing is hardly cause for joy. The reality is they're stealing our country, and they're doing it in the same manner that any street gang does, by acquisition of turf. And right now, your candidate for president is not chosen by you, the public. He or she is chosen by the two gangs. So let's call a party a party and a gang a gang. I can also say that with a straight face because I was a member of the Mongol Motorcycle Club, South Bay, California chapter. That was toward the end of my service as a Navy SEAL, and after my discharge from active duty. Eventually, I became the sergeant-at-arms of my chapter before I left in 1974. Of course, even in the outlaw motorcycle world, we don't call ourselves gangs. We're motorcycle clubs. That's what you see on the back of every jacket, MC, for motorcycle club. Just like the gun club or the chess club, you pick a name to project the image that you want, whether it's true or not, such as the Democratic Party, gang, and the Republican Party, gang. Of course, nobody gets shot, generally speaking. They just get paid off and set up. Think Monica Lewinsky and Clinton's impeachment. However, some of these gang members do go to jail like other gangsters. For instance, Governor Goodhair, Hot Rod Blagojevich, who got caught on tape saying what the other gang members say in private. All right, time to get serious. There's another comparison to be drawn between political and street gangs, and that's collateral damage to innocent civilians. Think about it. When bikers fight in a bar, and occasionally guns get drawn, if somebody happens to get in the way, too bad. When politicians fight each other within our government and take their bribes from the lobbyists, we're the ones who always pay the price. It's not only about war, but also about collateral damage to people losing their homes and jobs. So what is this book about, and what am I advocating? If the word gang offends you, then for this paragraph I'll use the term cabal for party leaders who are out to maintain their hegemony over our system of government, much to the detriment of most Americans, not to mention the ideals and intentions of the Founding Fathers. Or I'll use another analogy, pro wrestling. I know that sounds kind of silly, but it's true. The two gangs pretend to be adversaries in front of the public, good cop, bad cop, depending on whether you're sitting in the high-priced seats or the bleachers. But ultimately, they're both working for the same things, maintaining their power, getting richer, and making sure their wealthy backers keep control of the ship of state. I've often been asked, what has gone so fundamentally wrong with our country? My response is that the Democrats and Republicans are equally responsible and equally guilty because they've been in charge for over 150 years. They've created a system based upon bribery. Today, Wall Street owns our politicians, no matter which party, gang, it is. Their allegiance is to the corporations and big business. We basically have two bankrupt parties bankrupting the country, is the way a Stanford political scientist Larry Diamond put it. The loose definition of fascism is when corporations take over government, and I think in the United States, we're right on the brink of that, if we're not there already. Consider the following. Wall Street gets bailed out while average homeowners who got bilked by the banks go broke. Not one streetwise exec gets prosecuted for mega fraud, but if you get caught selling an ounce of marijuana, hasta la vista, baby. American Airlines declares bankruptcy so they won't have to pay their debts or renegotiate their labor contracts. But the law doesn't let a regular family declare personal bankruptcy to renegotiate their mortgage. We hear all the Republicans squawking about the budget deficit, but the true reason it's been growing is because of how big money has corrupted the government, including the thievery of our election process. These are some of the things that the Occupy Wall Street, OWS movement, which was born in Manhattan's Zuccotti Park in the heart of Wall Street, and has sprouted up around the world, are protesting about. They're not all opposed to capitalism. I love Wall Street. I just don't like the crooks and conspirators who run it. The occupiers are simply saying, stop it, Wall Street. Stop buying the allegiance of our politicians. They want leaders, not politicians, who are committed to the challenges of average people, to put a roof over their head and food on their table. They want proof that their leaders are acting for the greater common good and not simply out of greed or lust for power. They want leaders who are accountable for their actions. Like President Truman said, the buck stops here. Despite the media spin that the occupiers are sex-crazed 20-somethings with nothing better to do than loaf, party, and trash the parks, the facts bear out that the OWS movement is diverse, and its members are older than you think. For every young person, there is one in his or her 40s. The occupiers are from all walks of life, and supporters are sending contributions from as many as 37 countries. Almost half the people polled by the New York Times CBS News in October 2011 said they believed the sentiment at the root of the Occupy movement generally reflects the views of most Americans. They want higher taxes for corporations and millionaires and a more even distribution of wealth. But full 89% of Americans say they distrust the government to do the right thing. So these demonstrations seem to be waking more people up. In Minnesota, I wanted to be the first political face in the country to come forward and support this movement. I went down there about half a dozen times. One night, I made a trip to the hardware store and bought all the hand warmers they had, which I took down to the park in a big bag and set on their table. I said, "Hey, I'm too old to spend the night, but for you young people doing this, these will help keep you warm." Now get this. In Minnesota, they wouldn't allow generators for the people to keep warm. They say no generators are permitted in the park. But there was a generator there, and it was running 24/7. You know what it was for? It had a camera on top of a pole, keeping all the protesters under surveillance. So it's okay for the government, but for people to keep warm exercising their First Amendment rights, it's not allowed. One set of rules for one side, a different set for the other side. You'll hear more about what's happening to the Bill of Rights in our supposed democracy as this book unfolds. It's my hope that this book puts forward a step toward winning back our country. For the first time, I've taken a new position. From my perspective, I can't be an advocate anymore for third-party politics. I know this might stun some people, but I no longer support any third party. I happily wore that banner with pride for 6 or 7 years. However, we've got to face the reality that the two parties control the system to such an extent that, to be viable, a third party would have to sell out and become just as bad. Look at the Tea Party. It's already become corrupt. I'll spell out the details as we go along. When the major players are Glenn Beck and his ilk, I don't see that as a good alternative. It just adds another head to the already two-headed monster. So I'm in favor of abolishing all political parties within the system. To what level can we take that? Do we have the ability to remove them from ballots, to where people simply run by their names and are not identified by party? Wouldn't it then become incumbent upon us, the people, to know who these people are, rather than simply going out and voting for a specific party line? The party line isn't what our country was supposed to be about. If we go back to our founding fathers, when they created these United States, it wasn't so that we would go vote for the political agenda of a particular group. They had in mind that we would vote for individuals and what each individual stood for. Now, could the individual be endorsed by a political party? Certainly that could happen, just the same as you could be endorsed by any other special interest group, the teachers' union or whatever. It still leaves that freedom in place. But the domination by these gangs has got to end. Hey, if competition is good for our economy, why isn't the same true for our politics? I'll be laying out some heavy, maybe unpleasant truths in this book. You'll learn about the money trail that leads from the rich and powerful and their lobbyists to the politicians, and how that puts a stranglehold on our democracy. You'll get my take on the Obama administration and on the various rival Republican gang members challenging the Democrats in the 2012 election. You'll learn about the perils of computerized elections and how they take away our fundamental right to vote. You'll see how the politicians get perks that you can't and get away with shit that you'd go to jail for. You'll be chilled, as I've been, to learn about the police state tactics that are undermining our freedoms and values, about the role of the media in maintaining business as usual when it comes to the politics in this country, and how the constitutional guarantee about separation of church and state is becoming a moot point. You'll learn about third-party politics, both historically and personally from my experience, and hopefully understand my call to get away from all that. And I'll be laying out something of a blueprint for how we might leave behind all the party-line bullshit and in the process restore our country to what it used to stand for. Let's first look at what the founders of our great country had to say about political parties. It might surprise you. Chapter 2. What the Founders Said and Did. Our founding fathers created the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. What was their perception of political parties? Did they want them to have the power that we see so clearly today? Did they want them submitting the candidates you would vote for as president? Did they want platforms to come out of political parties and candidates to have the party next to their names? These are all questions I've been wondering about, and going back to our beginnings seems like a good place to start, especially since so many politicians in both the Democratic and Republican parties, gangs, are so fond of fabrications about the founders so as to justify their own actions. George Washington, as it turns out, hated the whole idea of political parties that pitted one group of citizens against another. Here is what Washington had to say in his farewell speech in 1796. They, political parties, serve to organize faction, to give it an artificial and extraordinary force, to put in the place of the delegated will of the nation the will of a party, often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and, according to the alternate triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by the common councils and modified by mutual interests. However, combinations or associations of the above description may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely, in the course of time and things, to become potent engines, by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. Was Washington far-seeing or what? We've become the United States of usurpers, and if I may continue the thought, based on usury. Later in that same speech, Washington went on to warn about what political parties can ultimately lead to. The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, which in different ages and countries has perpetrated the most horrid enormities, is itself a frightful despotism. But this leads at length to a more formal and permanent despotism. The disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later the chief of some prevailing faction, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purposes of his own elevation, on the ruins of public liberty. There you have it. Direct from the mouth of one of the fathers of our country. Keep in mind that when the Constitutional Convention took place in 1787, there weren't yet any official political parties. The debate over the Republic's future did have two sides. The Federalists were in favor of a strong, centralized government, while the Anti-Federalists were worried that the position of the president could devolve into a monarchy, like the English one we'd just broken away from, and that the rights of the states and of individuals would be compromised. The Federalist Party started off really and truly as a faction formed by Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury under President Washington. A rival faction formed around Thomas Jefferson, who, as Secretary of State, opposed Hamilton's idea for a powerful federal government. Like the Bloods who built up their rival gang, the Crips, the divide between Hamilton and Jefferson spawned two national parties. The Federalists, with Hamilton and John Adams, versus the Democratic Republican Party, with Thomas Jefferson as well as James Madison, the father of the Constitution. That's the first time anything resembling partisan party politics occurred in our country, and it was during Washington's first term. But even though he was sympathetic to the Federalist Party, Washington was pretty much an independent, and he sure foresaw the pitfalls if the country partied on. So did our second president, John Adams, who once said, There is nothing I dread so much as a division of the Republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and converting measures into opposition to each other. Adams believed that political parties were to be feared as the greatest political evil under our Constitution. So here is what a columnist for USA Today had to say recently about our second president. Adams feared big political parties for what they have become, polarizing institutions rather than mediating ones. He did not trust concentration of power. He would wonder about states passing laws making it so difficult for other political organizations to get on ballots. Never mind the prophetic thinking of Washington and Adams, things were still shaping up along party lines early on. In 1796, the Federalists took the states in the North, except Pennsylvania, while the Democratic Republicans took the South. Then 4 years later, the Federalists got voted out, and Thomas Jefferson came into office. He'd been a huge supporter of including the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, and part of his argument was that it was needed to protect citizens against government monopolies. With what's going on today, he must be turning over in his grave. Jefferson didn't feel as strongly as Washington and Adams did about the notion of parties. In 1798, Jefferson wrote, "In every free and liberating society there must, from the nature of man, be opposite parties and violent dissensions and discords. And one of these, for the most part, must prevail over the other for a longer or shorter time." But Jefferson also had his doubts. "Were parties here divided merely by a greediness for office," he said, "to take a part with either would be unworthy of a reasonable or moral man." And after he became president, Jefferson said flat out, "The greatest good we can do our country is to heal its party divisions and make them one people." It might be that Jefferson had some pangs about what went down in 1800. He believed strongly that government had no right to trample on the rights of the individual. In his words, "Financiers, bankers, and industrialists make cities the cesspools of corruption." But getting elected meant bringing in some new tactics and techniques. One of these was the media, which was only newspapers at the time. Editorials slamming the opposition popped up everywhere, and some said that the newspapers elected Jefferson. It was the good fortune of Republicans to have within their ranks a number of highly gifted political manipulators and propagandists, according to Fisher Ames, a one-time member of the House of Representatives and contemporary. Candidates were said to present their positions to coin the compelling slogan in appeal to the electorate on any given issue in a language it could understand. Sound familiar? Maybe it's not too surprising that the famous gun duel where Aaron Burr shot Alexander Hamilton took place a few years later, a pretty specific indication of the gang-like quality at the foundational level of American politics, wouldn't you say? Burr coming on the scene really marked the beginning of party politics, and Hamilton believed that Burr's self-interested nature made him unfit to hold the highest office in the land. In an 1801 letter to his friend, John McHenry, who had been Secretary of War under Washington and Adams, Hamilton wrote, "Nothing has given me so much chagrin as the intelligence that the Federal Party were thinking seriously of supporting Mr. Burr for president. I should consider the execution of the plan as devoting the country and signing their own death warrant. Mr. Burr will probably make stipulations, but he will laugh in his sleeve while he makes them and will break them the first moment it may serve his purpose." Sound like Burr was the forefather of more than a few of today's politicians? Burr didn't have Goldman Sachs in his corner, but he's the guy who decided to enlist the Tammany Hall Social Club to fuel his machine, which developed the techniques for organizing the party in New York. All Burr believed in was political power, and he was America's first truly amoral candidate for higher office. Maybe it's no accident that Burr was also the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, the Connecticut theologian who wrote the famous sermon about sinners in the hands of an angry God. Hell was a real place, according to Grandpa Edwards. What about our fourth president, James Madison, whom we might call a moral aristocrat? As a leading advocate for the limited role of government, believing the feds needed to be tightly restrained, Madison once put it like this: "In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and, in the next place, oblige it to control itself. But Madison did need to help create party politics in order to get Jefferson elected against the Hamiltonians. And by 1812, when Madison was president, we find that politicians started looking to manipulate, dare I say, cheat on elections. That year, the governor of Massachusetts, Elbridge Gerry, redrew the boundaries of legislative districts to corral voters into blocks that would support his Democratic-Republican Party over its rival, the Federalists. In one instance, Governor Gerry changed the district lines in such a way that it came to resemble that of a salamander. Hence we have the term gerrymander, which still refers to the election manipulation tactic of redrawing district lines to benefit the incumbent political party, gang. In 1820, the Mason-Dixon line was extended west to define the boundary between slave and free states, geographically emphasizing a rift that had been widening between the North and South for decades. As the national mood grew tenser over the issue of slavery, political parties lost traction for a brief period of time. By the 1820s, the Federalists had dissolved entirely, and the only party in existence, the Democratic Republicans, was starting to splinter. In 1824, four different men ran for president, all independent of parties, gangs: Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, William Crawford, and John Quincy Adams. Jackson got the most votes, both electoral and popular, but Clay cut a deal, and the House of Representatives selected Adams over the other candidates, not unlike the Supreme Court selecting George W. Bush over Al Gore, winner of the popular vote in 2000. Then Adams made Clay his Secretary of State as part of the deal, what Jackson called the corrupt bargain. Old Hickory was, not surprisingly, furious, and this was when our modern gangland politics truly began. Now, I'm a strong admirer of Jackson. Up until he came along, our presidents had been privileged citizens, endowed with monetary wealth, at least in comparison to the people they were representing. But Jackson wasn't rich, and the common man could easily relate to him. He was a real everyday person and former military man who just happened to be running for office. A bit like somebody else I know. Hint, a former wrestler. A few of my favorite Jackson quotes are these. "I've always been afraid of banks. It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the axe of government to their own selfish purposes. I weep for the liberty of my country when I see at this early day of its successful experiment that corruption has been imputed to many members of the House of Representatives, and the rights of the people have been bartered for promises of office. Unless you become more watchful in your states and check the spirit of monopoly and thirst for exclusive privileges, you will, in the end, find that the control over your dearest interests has passed into the hands of these corporations. The people are the government, administering it by their agents. They are the government, the sovereign power." The irony is that Jackson, running again in 1828, marked the beginning of how money came to infect virtually every aspect of the electoral process. Because Jackson didn't have the cash to put together another bid for the White House, he organized a campaign staff to go out and raise money for his candidacy. You can hardly blame him, but that hadn't happened before, at least to this extent. And guess who Jackson's stage manager was? A fellow named Martin Van Buren, who'd set up a political machine called the Bucktails in 1817 in New York. Their emphasis was on party loyalty, and Van Buren was a New York protege of Aaron Burr. Van Buren was so smart at manipulating the machine that he became known as the Little Magician. Now he became the prime mover behind the Jacksonian Democrats in a nasty mud-slinging campaign where you appeal to the people and tell them what they want to hear, and what you want them to hear. Jackson accused Adams of gambling recklessly with taxpayer money. Adams responded by calling Jackson an adulterer and a bigamist. Some of the press referred to Jackson as a jackass, which was how the donkey became the symbol of the Democrats. When the results were announced, with Jackson the winner, he invited one and all of his supporters to attend the inaugural party at the White House, and they trashed the place, destroying lights and furniture and breaking punch bowls, acting a lot like an L.A. street gang. Jackson's wife, Rachel, after complaining about chest pains and other related aggravations due to Adams' personal attacks on her marriage, died suddenly in December 1828. Jackson later accused the Adams campaign of causing her death, and lo and behold, the two-party system was born. Jackson and his Secretary of State, Van Buren, with the Democrats, and Adams and Clay opposing them eventually as the Whigs. Van Buren soon became president himself in 1837. From 1833 onward, those two parties had a stranglehold over elections in the United States until the Civil War. The Republicans originally came into being as a third party. That's what Abraham Lincoln was, lest we forget amidst the bozos that pass for Republicans today. And since the Whigs fell apart around that time, we've seen those other two parties dominate our politics for the past 150 years. That's getting a little stale, wouldn't you say? I can't end this chapter without a quote from one of our founding mothers, for lack of a better term. I just found out recently that the lyrics to our grand anthem, America the Beautiful, were written in 1894 by a Massachusetts poet named Catherine Lee Bates. She turns out to have been a passionate feminist who was also extremely upset about the Gilded Age of greed that the country was then experiencing. The third verse, that we don't hear today but should hear, now more than ever, said this: America, America, God shed his grace on thee, till selfish gain no longer stain the banner of the free. So would our forefathers and mothers be comfortable with the system that we see today? Sure, they talked against parties and factions, but they also were the ones that created them. But I have to believe they would not be happy with what our system has evolved into. They never could have realized how powerful these parties would become in a time of mass politics and excessive wealth. It's time for the new revolution, the refounding of the country. Chapter 3: The Natural Order of Things Today. In 1976, I was just starting out as Jesse the Body Ventura when the film Network was released. But I remember like it was yesterday the speech Mr. Jensen gives to Mr. Beale, where he lays out the natural order of things today. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies, Mr. Beale. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. Mr. Jensen concludes that our children will live to see one vast and ecumenical holding company, for which all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused. It was one of those electric movie moments that, in hindsight, can only be called prophetic. I wish it was sci-fi, believe me. Not that we weren't warned. Abraham Lincoln had this to tell America back in 1864. Corporations have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands, and the republic is destroyed. That was more than 100 years before Network, folks. After that, we had our robber baron era, that of uber-rich industrialists like John Jacob Astor, Andrew Mellon, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, our Gilded Age. And then Theodore Roosevelt busting the trusts and FDR taking on the big bankers during the Great Depression. Then came the 60s and the Vietnam War, followed by Nixon and Watergate. A lot of government secrets began coming out, like how the CIA assassinated foreign leaders, domestic too, but that never got admitted, and experimented with mind control, using human beings as unwitting guinea pigs to test experimental drugs. You can learn about much of this history in two of my earlier books, American Conspiracies and 63 Documents the Government Doesn't Want You to Read. However, before we examine the result of all this in today's political world, I want to stay with some recent history because it's important to understand the background and to realize that what's come to a head with the marriage of corporations and politics has been getting worse and worse for more than 30 years. Probably no historian has spelled this out more clearly than the late Howard Zinn in his book, A People's History of the United States, and that's the book I'm going to draw on for the facts and figures you'll be hearing here. In 1960, the year John F. Kennedy squeaked out a narrow victory over Richard Nixon, 63% of the eligible voters exercised their right. By 1976, the year Network came out, that number had dropped to 53%. More and more they, the people, declared, if only by non-participation, their alienation from the political system. Politicians were no longer inspiring because it seemed that behind the bombast, the rhetoric, the promises, their major concern was their own political power. Back then, the parties were already devolving into the gangs they are today. At a turning point, Democrat Jimmy Carter's tax reforms mainly benefited the corporations and their CEOs. The scale of wealth was the only major difference between then and now. At that time, multinationals, as they were known, were a group that constituted the third largest economy in the world, right behind the United States and the Soviet Union. While Exxon Oil's net income rose 56% to more than $4 billion, 3,000 small independent gasoline stations went out of business in 1979, a portent of things to come. Along came Ronald Reagan, who was followed by George H.W. Bush. By the fall of 1991, Reagan and Bush had filled more than half of the 837 federal judgeships and appointed enough right-wing justices to transform the Supreme Court. Remember the awarding of the 2000 election to George Bush and the court's recent decision declaring that corporations are legal persons? In the 80s, the big oil company bosses contributed $270,000 to redecorate the White House living quarters. I guess they figured that they owned it. Soon after, Reagan turned mandatory enforcement of our environmental laws into a voluntary approach by big businesses. His 8 years in office were the start of a familiar litany. Cut social programs, increase spending on defense, cut taxes on the wealthy, and watch unemployment increase. 30 million people in 1982. With the help of Democrats in Congress, Reagan's administration lowered the tax rate on the richest people to 50%. Remember that during World War II, anybody making over $400,000 a year paid 91% of that to taxes. That was a time, maybe the last, when there was a sense that everybody was in this together. It had taken both officers and troops fighting together to win the war. So naturally what followed was the GI Bill for education to help out everyone who had fought for our country. There was far more equality in society, and there were attempts to create even more. And when Eisenhower was president through most of the 50s, the top tax rate was still around 90% and not much lower under Kennedy after that in the early 60s. And guess what? This was when the middle class was the most prosperous with lots of good jobs. Seems like those high taxes didn't really destroy jobs, as the gangsters keep telling us these days. But the times had changed by the late 70s. From 1978 under a Crip to 1990 under Two Bloods, the top 1% gained $1 trillion. Corporate CEOs, who made 40 times as much salary as the average factory worker in 1980, were earning 93 times as much by the end of the decade. Now, the difference is over 300 times as much. Less and less wealth was going to people who produced something, as Kevin Phillips said. And when the savings and loan scandal hit, bilking people out of billions in the 88 campaign, Michael Dukakis didn't point fingers at the Republicans because the Democrats in Congress were heavily involved in bringing about and then covering up the situation. No matter which party, gang, was in power, since World War II, the military budgets had continued to escalate, and Democrats and Republicans had long been joined in a bipartisan foreign policy, what Eisenhower had called the military-industrial complex in his farewell speech. During the Reagan-Bush years, we started getting more aggressive, either directly in invasions or through both overt and covert support of right-wing tyrannies that cooperated with the United States. Remember the Iran-Contra deal and Ali North guns for drugs, and all that. Later came Panama, where we took out dictator Manuel Noriega before he could snitch on how involved he was with our drug-dealing spies. And then the Desert Storm operation, where we invaded Iraq. Today, the military budget is about one-third of our total U.S. budget, and we spend more on military and related matters than all the other countries in the world combined. There might be some who argue that point, depending on what you include. But if you count veterans' benefits, there's no doubt about it. Through it all, as Howard Zinn put it, there was a political consensus of Democrats and Republicans in Washington which set limits on American reform, making sure that capitalism was in place, that national military strength was maintained, that wealth and power remained in the hands of a few. By the 1988 election, when Papa Bush ran against Dukakis, only 27% of eligible voters turned out. If you polled the people, 84% in 1990 wanted a surtax on millionaires. A majority also wanted a single-payer health care system. Clearly, there was something amiss with a political system supposed to be democratic, in which the desires of the voters were repeatedly ignored. We were a class society, where the top 1% by the 90s owned 33% of the wealth, while 30 to 40 million people lived in poverty. Did Bill Clinton bring the change he promised in the 90s? During his terms in office, big corporations started giving money to the Democratic Party gang on an unprecedented scale. In paving the Democrats' way for Obama, his key appointments to the Treasury and Commerce Departments were wealthy corporate lawyers, and his foreign policy staff, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the National Security Advisor, were traditional players on the bipartisan Cold War team. He didn't go for any new federal job programs and continued to spend at least $250 billion a year to maintain the military machine. In 1999, the United States sold over $11 billion of arms, one-third of all weapons sold worldwide. Clinton's foreign economic policy was in keeping with both major parties being more concerned for corporate interests than for the rights of working people here or abroad, and saw foreign aid as a political and economic tool more than as a humanitarian act. And people wonder why Ron Paul wants to cut off foreign aid. While Clinton talked tough on law and order, the FBI's assault on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, resulted in the deaths by fire of at least 86 men, women, and children. The 1996 crime bill, voted for overwhelmingly by both parties, gangs, and endorsed with enthusiasm by Clinton, extended the death penalty to a whole range of criminal offenses and provided $8 billion for the building of new prisons. And the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act in 1996 allowed the deportation of any immigrant ever convicted of a crime, no matter how long ago or how serious. Did you know that we incarcerate more of our people, both total and per capita, than any other country in the world? And that the rate of incarceration starting in 1980 tracks completely with the increase in wealth inequality? And that we have the fifth highest rate of executions, only exceeded by those fine democracies, China, Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia? Do you think that might hint at being a measure of failure in our society? We'll get to today's figures in the next chapter, but consider the precedents. The 400 richest families owned $92 billion in 1982. But 13 years later, this had jumped to $480 billion. In the 90s, the wealth of the 500 corporations of the Standard & Poor's Index had increased by 335%. The Dow Jones average of stock prices had gone up 400% between 1980 and 1995, while the average wage of workers had declined in purchasing power by 15%. In 1998, one of every three working people in the United States had jobs paying at or below the federal poverty level. For the 2000 election, the Bush campaign raised $220 million, and the Al Gore campaign $170 million. You'll be amazed to compare this with today's figures. Coming attraction advertisement. It was often hard to tell the difference between where the candidates stood on issues, yes for death penalty and big military spending, for example. Only Ralph Nader's third-party effort emphasized things like education, environment, and health care, but they wouldn't let him take part in the debates. As soon as the Supreme Court handed Bush the presidency, he pushed tax cuts for the wealthy, opposed strict environmental regulations that would cost money for the business interests, and planned to privatize Social Security by having the retirement funds of citizens depend on the stock market. The way was being paved for today's crusaders. Then came September 11, about which I continue to believe we've not been told the full truth. When a lie that big can be perpetrated on the people, you know it's just about game over. I've covered my thoughts about this in American Conspiracies and more than once on my television show, Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. But let me pause to refresh your memory about the USA Patriot Act that passed in Congress with one dissenting vote, enact, which gave the Department of Justice the power to detain non-citizens simply on suspicion, without charges, without the procedural rights provided in the Constitution. It said the Secretary of State could designate any group as terrorist, and any person who was a member of or raised funds for such an organization could be arrested and held until deported. 9/11 and the subsequent invasion of Iraq and toppling of Saddam swept under the rug further inquiry about Enron, WorldCom, or Bush's banking regulators taking a chainsaw to thousands of pages of things that Wall Street took exception to, decisions that allowed the free market to operate as a barroom brawl. Goldman Sachs CEO Hank Paulson, before he became Treasury Secretary, went to the Securities and Exchange Commission to get lending restrictions relaxed for the five big investment banks. After that, Goldman went berserk with lending lust. By the peak of the housing boom in 2006, Goldman was underwriting $76.5 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities, a third of which were subprime, much of it to institutional investors like pensions and insurance companies. And in those massive issues of real estate were vast swamps of crap. Considering all this, recall the words of Thomas Jefferson from 1774 in Rights of British America, 2 years before the Revolution began. Single acts of tyranny may be ascribed to the accidental opinion of a day, but a series of oppressions begun at a distinguished period and pursued unalterably through every change of ministers too plainly prove a deliberate, systematic plan of reducing a people to slavery. Near the end of his People's History, Howard Zinn also said something prophetic, anticipating the OWS movement that he didn't live to see take shape in our country. These struggles would involve all the tactics used at various times in the past by people's movements: demonstrations, marches, civil disobedience, strikes and boycotts and general strikes, direct action to redistribute wealth, to reconstruct institutions, to revamp relationships, creating a new joy in the collaboration of people. There would be many defeats. But when such a movement took hold in hundreds of thousands of places all over the country, it would be impossible to suppress, because the very guards the system depends on to crush such a movement would be among the rebels. It would be a new kind of revolution, the only kind that could happen, I believe, in a country like the United States. It would take enormous energy, sacrifice, commitment, patience. But because it would be a process over time, starting without delay, there would be the immediate satisfactions that people have always found in the affectionate ties of groups striving together for a common goal.